Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the case for school choice. And Richard, we're basing this conversation on a column that you recently had in the Las Vegas Review-Journal about school choice in Nevada. Zoom out a little today and talk about the principles of school choice more broadly. So let's just start with the basics. America has public schools, free to attend, at least in a point of purchase sense. They're generally funded by your local property taxes. And it has private schools where people who have other needs or desires for their children's educations can pay out of pocket to give their kids the kind of education that they want. So what's this thing called school choice, and why do we need to insert it into a world that already has those two paths available?
Well, I think what you have to do is to look at different segments of the population and see the way in which they respond. First of all, if you start talking about those people who have sufficient funds in order to send their children to religious or private schools of their own choice, you're talking about a relatively sunny scenario. Those schools tend to be pretty strong, and the kids are relatively pleased. But the downside of this is very important to understand. Anybody who's spending 100% of their own money to educate their own children is going to be highly disinclined to support public schools from which their children will get no benefits at all. In addition, elderly taxpayers or people without children will have the same kind of situation. So the success of the private schools will lead to all sorts of complications. People will start to leave tax environments in which a huge amount of money is paid for education. And in local government, education is usually the largest expenditure by far. And so you'll start seeing the segregation of community where people with children will essentially leave, people without children will stay. This will then create all sorts of other problems. So, for example, if you go back to the great racial zoning case of the city of Mount Laurel, the battle was we want to make sure that our zoning laws are such so as to allow poorer minority children to come into this particular community with their families, so open up the zoning system. And the opposition on the other side was, at this particular point, we are paying relatively little for children's education because we don't have all that many. You change the racial composition, that may be fine, but it turns out that the number of school children per person who lives in the community is going to go way up, the taxes will go up, and then I leave for you to decide which of the two parts of the double motive, race or expense, are dominating the situation. So this is a serious kind of problem. On the other side, you have people who are in public schools who don't have the option and who don't pay huge amounts in taxes, but on whom a huge amount of money is spent. So in New York City, that number could be close to $20,000 a year for public school students. But they don't have any choices. And so if the current system is going to operate, the money is spent. Much of it is captured in the form of monopoly rents by teachers and other unions, and the education is very poor because there's very little incentive on the part of the institutions to improve the education of these children because they don't have any effective exit rights. The Milton Friedman solution, which was put forward many, many years ago, 1963 in Capitalism and Freedom, was, look, we need to have public funding of education, not so much for the rich, but surely for the poor. But we don't have to have the government running these programs. So what we will do is we will create a voucher, and you could take that money and not spend it on anything that you want, but you can spend it on education, and there will be relatively few conditions as to which you can do it, so there'll be a competition within the system. Originally, the dominant form of this was you went to private schools and offered them your vouchers. More recently, the movement has been towards charter schools, which are schools that are chartered by the state and are run relatively autonomously by their organizers. So my son Elliot, several years ago, used to work for the Success Academy in New York and in many other types of situations. They get the public monies. They put them together. And it turns out that their capacity, since they're smaller units, for innovation and improvement are extremely strong, and in head-to-head competition with the public schools, they tend to do very well. one of the nice effects of this is if it turns out that public schools are now faced with competition and they're trying to keep their students in order to keep their teachers in position, they actually do better when they're in competition with private schools than they do when they're given the monopoly position. And this is true of all union behavior. You put an exit option in for a union and the union starts to behave in a different fashion than it does when there's no such exit option. This is basically another application of the general principles, which progressives tend not to like, but which I think are always true, is that the more you get to a competitive equilibrium, the higher level of production that you have. And so the charter school movement, the voucher school movement, are all designed to break up a public school monopoly and still allow financing for those people who cannot afford it. And if you give money to those people who can afford it, you get rid of all the dislocations when they try to opt out of the system, move away, vote against taxes, and the like.
When you make a case like the one that you just made about the success of charter schools, the response that you will get, especially from teachers' unions in a lot of cases, is if they acknowledge that they do well, they say, look, we get it, but these charter schools, they pick their own students and they take the cream of the crop. And so, of course, they do well, and then they leave all the kids who are the hardest cases in public schools. So by their very nature, charter schools are fundamentally weakening the existing public system. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, again, the charges are actually wrong. The way in which it works with most charter schools is not something I advocate, but essentially is that people apply randomly and essentially are chosen randomly so that the school has no power of selection except for people who want to come in. And at that particular point, it's not a situation in which it turns out that the only people who are left are the dregs. So somebody will say, look, there's still a selection effect here because it's only the more enterprising parents who will essentially apply for this. The less enterprising parents may not. So what they've also done is run studies where the only group of individuals you look at are those people who have applied to private schools, some have gotten in and some not, and you still see very prominent disparities taking place in performance when you control for that population. Second point that one always wants to make about this is you're talking here about a serious problem with special education and special needs kids. This is a tremendously costly thing to do because special ed kids, you may have to spend two or three times the amount of money on them that you do for a kid who has no such disabilities. But the way in which the public school system works is they get additional funds for all the special ed kids that come in, and you could do exactly the same thing with respect to the charter schools. So what you do essentially is if you say as follows, that the charter schools will get two-thirds the amount of money that the public school gets for any given kid, that usually is enough to account for the funding of a private school. That is, it could work on 67% of the income or the wealth that you need on the other system. You get rid of any of that kind of bias, and all of these differences still remain. So the question is, well, why does it happen? Well, you try and change a public school condition contract. And one of the things that I always say to people when they are kind of skeptical about this is you look at their contracts. And those union contracts are extremely complicated, extremely detailed. They have rigid requirements. When do you stand guard at lunch? When do you get off? What do you have to do here? What do you have to do there? What are the tenure requirements? They can be 100 pages. The lab school contracts, or that's the University of Chicago lab school, but the general charter school contracts are much shorter. This is the pay you get, these are the hours, and all of the sort of work that's done on a given daily basis is done through essentially informal negotiation. So there's a much greater level of flexibility in the operation, more teacher initiative, and a much greater willingness for people to change the way the system operates because the feedback mechanisms are much stronger. So you're dealing with a public school system, which is like a kind of a socialist economy in which everything is planned at the outset and there's no room for give and take or for modification, as opposed to a much more fluid organization. Now, nobody wants to have every teacher turn over every year because you don't have any institutional continuity. But generally speaking, if you have a rigid seniority situation, and no change in individuals, no change in rate structures, that's a big problem. Having a charter school system where you get 20% new blood every year or a 10% new blood every year is going to outperform that in a serious way, and that's generally what the evidence shows. The second point about this is if a public school fails, it goes on probation. There's a huge amount of politics as to whether or not it does or does not close down, how it's taken over, and so forth. If a charter school fails, goodbye. And nobody should keep them alive. Parents will vote with their feet. And so what happens is the strong networks tend to gain and start more schools. The weaker ones tend to drop out. They require more space, as they can do. And so the important thing to do is to make sure that the city or the state that funds them doesn't put an artificial cap on the number of people who can enroll in charter schools, which is the case today. So you can have a situation where a charter school will have space for, say, 500 students, and you get 5,000 applicants. Well, you know that even if you take 500 students, there's still going to be many grievously disappointed students. So the thing that you have to do is to expand supply. And if you looked at that Las Vegas illustration and you look in many other places, one of the strategies of the unions is to say, yes, we really do think that charter schools are sort of maybe perhaps okay, but we don't want any more than X spaces for charter schools. And essentially, if what you do is you limit the size of the competition, essentially you preserve 90% of the monopoly instead of 100%. And that turns out to have very deleterious consequences to ordinary people in the long run.
One of the criticisms of school choice that you'll often see, this is particularly true of homeschooling, which is admittedly its own kettle of fish, but you get into this with vouchers too, is you'll have people say, wait a minute, what if we turn this over to parents who want crazy things for their kids? So maybe they want their education to be structured around some sort of religious extremism, or maybe the parents want the kids to just run free to construct their own curriculum. That's actually a movement of its own. Or maybe they, because of their beliefs, they want a school of all children who don't get vaccines. And people will say, if you leave this all up to the parents, there are a lot of crazy parents out there, and you're going to end up with kids who are demonstrating antisocial behavior or kids who are totally unprepared for any real jobs and the vagaries of the labor market. What's your response to those kinds of concerns?
Well, I mean, look, there are crazy parents everywhere, some of whom are in public schools as well. When my son public schools, one of the serious problems that you had to face was that crazy parents would come in and make impossible demands on the way in which the particular system started to operate, and there was very little that you can do to kind of push them away, including counseling them out. One of the serious problems with crazy parents in any schools, if you don't control it, is how you administer meds to the students when they come in. Many students have real complications, attention deficits, disorders, and one of the things that happens is a crazy parent says, my kid needs Ritalin, but instead of giving him one dose in the morning and one in the afternoon, I'm going to give him two in the morning and none in the afternoon. So the kid arrives at school and he's a zombie for the first 3 hours. The pills wear off and he becomes a maniac. This is something which can happen in every education, and one of the things that charter schools do, much more than public schools, is they really bring the parents into the system. They enter into contracts as to what you're supposed to do, including the regulation of meds, how you do things at homework. It turns out many of these schools actually have uniforms as a way of trying to create some degree of coherence. And parents know what the norms are from the school. And if they're crazy and the norms are non-negotiable on these points, they're not going to go to those particular schools. It's also the case, we're not doing this just as a matter of speculation. There are already several million people who are homeschooled, several million people who are in charter schools of one kind or another under voucher program, and all of this stuff is hypothetical, but it's not really real in any given case. And that's because if you're a charter school, you really do worry about your reputation, and if you worry about your reputation, you can't survive the kinds of attacks that are going to be made if you do something wrong. And in fact, with the Success Academy some years ago, they were subject to a constant series of attacks by the New York Times and a reporter since moved named Kate Taylor. And it was really an enormously disruptive experience for trying to run a charter school when you're always under attack in the New York Times for one thing or another. And so one of the things that happens is if you're trying to wonder what makes it difficult to run a charter school, a lot of it is the strong almost intransigent objection to them by unions and union supporters. So I think, in effect, if you look around, if there is a particular case in which there's difficulty, you fix it. But you don't ban the situation today because of a 1 in 1,000 chance that something is going to happen tomorrow. Now, what about the outputs for students? The charter school systems have the following very serious problem, and they know it, which is we keep students in a very tight environment while they're with us. Once they go off to college, are they going to be able to keep the same level of standards in a very different kind of environment? But what they do is they really try to plan for this with career counselors, instructions, lots of help of one kind or another. The same problem exists in public schools, but they're much less responsive to it because it's not part of the union contract. When it comes to performance, there are standardized tests. Charter schools always do better, at least the good ones, than public schools, often located in the same building, on these tests. Now the charge is these schools are teaching too much to the test, and that's a bad thing. It's better than teaching to nothing at all. But if you do any kind of output measurement by standard test, the differences between the good charter schools and the ordinary public schools is very dramatic, and even the difference between the best public schools and the best charter schools are relatively strong. So I think, in effect, what happens is hypothetical arguments of this sort should never be encouraged. What you demand of somebody is to show me the school, show me the mistake, and the moment you point it out to the school, they will take steps to correct it. Whereas these problems in public schools could languish forever because there's nobody who's strongly incentivized to fix things. The union contracts are protected for the teachers, and in many school systems, the principals are unionized. And so what happens is the amount of freedom that you have in running the system is almost zero. You try to get somebody in to say, let's rationalize the budget, and you realize 85% of the budget is in the form of salaries for one kind of union employee or the other. So even if you could get a 10 or 20% efficiency on the rest of the money, you're talking about a 1% to 3% improvement of the overall system, which doesn't make a dent in it. The only thing that will get public schools essentially to do better is the competition from a whole variety of private schools. That's the basic truth in industry. And the moment you allow schools to say, we have to keep our student body up by capturing them, what you're doing is you're making children pawned in an educational structure being run by other people for their own purposes.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.